Rubyverse Podcast, Episode 9. Hi, I'm Mike Moore, and in this episode I talk with Brian Ford about Rubinius. This episode is sponsored by Ruby Threads, thoughtful shirts for thoughtful Rubyists. You can find them at www.rubythreads.com. When did you start working on Rubinius?
So I started working on Rubinius in December of 2006. I just heard about Rubinius. I didn't actually get to attend the RubyConf in 2006, where Rubinius was sort of announced, but I heard about it very shortly thereafter, and I went and checked it out, looked at a blog post that Evan had written, looked at the project a little bit. I hopped in the IRC channel, and I talked to Wilson Bilkovich, and I was very, very concerned that the Rubinius project wasn't trying to fork Ruby, but that they were going to be compliant with Ruby. And I was assured that that was the intent. It was simply to create a better implementation of Ruby, and basically just saw it as the program that I had been waiting, or the project rather, that I had been waiting a while to contribute to. I had looked at contributing to YARV early on and found it much less accessible than I had hoped, even though I was a C programmer. And in December, one of my first commits to Rubinius was the beginning of what would become Ruby spec. So I was really concerned about conforming to the language, the standard language, because I considered Motz's Ruby implementation, MRI, to be the standard. So that was December of 2006.
You are known as the creator of Ruby spec. Did you start Ruby spec before you started working on Rubinius, or was Ruby spec an outgrowth of Rubinius?
No, Ruby spec definitely was an outgrowth. It was basically a tool that I started creating for myself, really. I mean, to be perfectly honest, but for the project, because I knew, one, our spec was fairly new. I was actually in some measure involved in the very early talking about our spec. I had read Dave Estell's post looking at test-driven development from a new perspective and coining the term behavior-driven development. I was on the train, the Argonne Express, to the very first RailsConf, where Stephen Baker and a few of us sat around talking about syntax and how you would represent this best in Ruby. And I had been using RSpec on a number of projects. And so, number one, concerned about Rubinius adhering to the language standard. And number two, I knew that our development would be much more rapid if we had a really solid testing framework. So I started looking around and I found Ruby Test, which was a project that I believe Chad Fowler and Rich Kilmer had, and Dave Thomas had started a few years earlier. I looked at that, and then there was a sort of fork of that called the BFTS that I believe the Seattle RB guys, or Ryan Davis and Eric Hodel in particular, had been working on a little bit. And I just found things that weren't acceptable to me in either one of those. So really believing that RSpec syntax with the descriptions for the examples and the organization that brings and the need for a really solid test framework for Ruby, believing strongly in those things, I decided to start writing it. And Evan was really open to that. I was like, hey, he already had test unit stuff in the repository. I looked at that and I said, hey, Evan, do you have any problem with me adding RSpec-based tests? And he said, no problem. Go ahead. Have at it. And so that was the start of Ruby spec.
Can you speak a bit on the need for Ruby spec? When you started the project, there wasn't much of a standardization effort outside of the projects you mentioned.
I don't think they were in use extensively, simply because there weren't many alternative implementations. So at the time, JRuby was using every testing framework that they could get their hands on. And so they were, I'm pretty sure they were using the standard Ruby test, and they were using, I'm pretty sure they had MRI's own tests, which are different than Ruby test, and the BFTS stuff. I think they had all that stuff in their repository. There really wasn't any significant effort at an alternative implementation. So there wasn't really a need for standardization. Also, the idea of making sure that Ruby conformed to a standard, I don't think was on many people's minds. I mean, I wanted to avoid the situation with Lisp and the situation with Smalltalk and make sure that we had one Ruby language. I was really concerned about that, even though, you know, there were no other really viable alternative implementations besides MRI. Everybody used MRI. So it was more of a need. I mean, the opportunity was there, and at that point I felt the need was there. So that's why I started RubySpec. It wasn't like there were a bunch of fairly advanced alternative implementations and no one thought to bother with language specification. It's just that there wasn't really a need prior to that.
How useful has RubySpec been with more and more alternate Ruby implementations popping up?
I think it's been really useful. I mean, I hope it's been useful. I know that the reason we actually made it its own project instead of just having it in Rubinius was because of pressure from other implementations. I think over time it became apparent that it was the testing framework that was going to receive the most attention, I guess, because in Rubinius we were very much committed to it. I think other implementations had reservations about whether or not it was going to be useful, but as we were demonstrating with Rubinius, I mean, our first 4 or 5 months of work on Rubinius, we made a lot of improvement, and in some measure that was simply because there was tons of low-hanging fruit. We had lots of Ruby code that we could write, but also we had a lot of tests. It was very easy to go in and see exactly what was failing. And so basically after about 6 months, the pressure to make it its own project, because other implementations, I don't think really wanted to be like, oh yeah, we're using Rubinius stuff. They wanted to sort of stand on their own. So they wanted that to be sort of independent, more objective, I guess, or something. So that's where we actually made it its own project.
The Ruby core team in Japan is working on a specification for the Ruby language. How involved has RubySpec been in that process?
So the Ruby standardization project with Mats and a few other of the core Japanese contributors was an effort to create an ISO standard for the Ruby language. And what that means is basically a document that describes, according to a certain format, how the language is supposed to function, what sort of encoding is used to write the text of the program, how the program is processed, what sort of basic features are provided by the core library, what basic data types there are, these sorts of things. So there's a very interesting, I think, parallel to RubySpec. On the one hand, there's nothing in that standard that you can actually run with your program to show that your implementation, to show that it complies to the standard. So it's fascinating because we know really well, historically, with Internet Explorer and their support for CSS, for instance, that a written standard, while it's valuable because at least we have something concrete that we can all refer to, it's also very difficult to ensure that something that we claim to conform to the standard or that we've worked very hard to try to ensure conforms to the standard actually does. And so RubySpec and the standardization project are actually, I believe, complementary. Also, while RubySpec itself, the project to create an executable specification of the Ruby programming language, RubySpec attempts to describe all facets of behavior for 186, 187, and 192. The Ruby ISO standard, on the other hand, more nebulously describes something called the Ruby programming language, and it doesn't tie it as tightly to a specific version, and it doesn't cover the entirety of the behavior. It covers a core subset that should be consistent with MRI 187, MRI 192, and other alternative implementations. And the focus of that ISO standard really is to provide legitimacy for folks who are using Ruby to develop applications for, say, governments or other people who have that sort of requirement in their process when they decide who to grant contracts to, that sort of thing. So it's more of a legal or at least formality in that realm, sort of in the realm of business and commerce. Whereas RubySpec is really about verifying compatibility and providing a developer tool, something that you can use to actively test your implementation to ensure that there's consistent behavior on different platforms, operating systems, CPU architectures, across versions of the language, and across implementations. So to summarize, I guess I would say that whereas the ISO standard is a written document, it's more for people to read and contracts to sign, that sort of thing. RubySpec itself is more of a sort of living, executable thing. We improve it constantly, and you can actually run it to see what's going on.
How would Rubinius have been impacted if that standardization effort or that specification had been in existence when you started?
That's a good question. I don't think it really would have been impacted. I mean, there's nothing. It might have made writing some of the specs easier, but honestly, I mean, I spent many hours with the Pickaxe book following Dave Thomas's, you know, fantastic documentation of Ruby and just analyzing methods for their different behaviors. A lot of that information is now in the ISO standard, and it potentially would have been a place to get that information. But really, Dave Thomas, you know, did the Ruby community such an incredible service by working on that book and documenting so much stuff for us in English. And I referred to it so much that I think that we weren't really at a disadvantage trying to write Ruby spec by poring over lots of C code. Although we did often have to resort to the C code to understand some of the stuff. It was not the first thing. So I think the Ruby ISO standard probably wouldn't have impacted Rubinius much, but it may have been an additional resource.
About a year ago, Evan wrote an article about the history of Rubinius. Can you talk a bit to that history and when you got involved?
Sure. Some of the history of Rubinius I only know from Evan's report. So initially, Evan was a sort of interested in virtual machines and Ruby, and he had been studying the Smalltalk book, the Blue Book on the implementation of Smalltalk in the language. I believe that it's Smalltalk, the language and its implementation. So he had initially written Rubinius in Ruby, and it ran on top of MRI and used some special stuff to access raw memory so he could write a garbage collector. And the rest of the virtual machines are in Ruby. And of course, it was slow because it was doing an awful lot of stuff that is typically done in machine code or in a very low level language like C. So when RubyConf 2006, when Evan first discussed it, it was just before that he started writing the actual virtual machine or the bytecode interpreter itself in C. And that was the first VM. And he named it Shotgun. I don't know where that name comes from. But it was a C virtual machine. The garbage collector and the bytecode interpreter were written in C, but the tiny portion of the core libraries that we had at the time and the bytecode compiler were still written in Ruby. So the bytecode compiler takes Ruby source code, it uses a parser to convert it to an internal representation, typically referred to as an abstract syntax tree or AST, and processes that AST into a set of instructions that are much like machine code instructions that your CPU executes directly, but they're higher level typically, and they're commonly referred to as bytecodes. So from the point when Evan rewrote the VM in C, which was just before I started with the project in 2006, December 2006, all the way through, I would say, about March of 2008, we used that virtual machine, Shotgun, written in C. A lot of interesting stuff happened in that time. So Ezra was working with EngineYard. He was one of the co-founders of EngineYard. And he had seen stuff about Rubinius, and he was really impressed with it. And he had mentioned it to Tom Mornini, who was another one of the founders of EngineYard. And Ezra basically said, this is a project to watch. I think it's going to be pretty outstanding. And in June, I believe, of 2007, EngineYard actually offered Evan a job And that was pretty outstanding because it was about 6-7 months after Rubinius was announced as a project. We had made a lot of progress. We had written a ton of Ruby specs. We had written a lot of core library stuff, what we call the kernel, in Ruby. And Rubinius was making a lot of progress. We were really excited about it. We thought that, naively, as it turns out, but we thought that we could be running Rails by RubyConf 2007, which would be about a year from when the project was first announced. And while we were able to run a lot of stuff, we weren't quite running Rails by then. But RubyConf 2007 was an exciting time. Basically, since Rubinius had been making so much progress so quickly, and because there was so much excitement about Ruby and Rails, and the market was really growing for that, Engineer took a gamble and actually hired a number of additional developers to work full-time on Rubinius. So I started in January of 2008. It was, you know, an amazing opportunity, dream job. Basically, they sponsored me to work on Ruby spec, Rubinius, basically all the work that I was already doing in every spare moment that I had for a year. Now that was going to be my full-time job. So I was pretty stoked about that. So Engineer ultimately hired 4 other developers besides Evan. And we worked on that. And we did get Rails running on Rubinius on the C Shotgun VM, pretty much around the time for RailsConf in 2008. That was pretty exciting. There was, you know, still a lot of compatibility issues, but it was basically running unmodified Rails stack. We could process requests through, we could hit the database, and it was pretty exciting. But it was about that time that Evan was looking at the architecture of the VM, the virtual machine that was written in C. And there were a lot of things that were kind of kludgy. The C programming language itself is an okay language for some things, but there's just a lot of stuff that makes it not the greatest language to use to implement the very primitive operations that are needed in a beautiful object-oriented language like Ruby. And so Evan started experimenting with C++ at that time, because C++ had some object-oriented extensions to C, basically, that made it a much more suitable language. So he started experimenting with that, and basically worked on it for about 3 weeks, and then he let us know. He's like, hey, I've been experimenting with C++. I have a VM almost written in C++. It's looking pretty cool. I think it's going to be useful. And so after RailsConf in 2008, we basically transitioned to, you know, full force getting everything modified and switched over to the C++ VM, which doesn't have a name. It's in the VM directory in the source code. So it's just, we just refer to it as the Rubinius VM now. It is written in C++. We have a lot of facilities that make it really, really nice to interface with Ruby. So to delve into some technical details, one of the things that we fundamentally have to have when implementing a language like Ruby, which has no way to describe adding two machine integers together, for instance, or actually how you concatenate two primitive arrays of characters. These sorts of things are sort of below the surface of the programming language itself. So your only option to implement those primitive things is some other language. Now, you can take a dialect of Ruby and give it different semantics and use that, or you could use C, or you could use C++, or you could use Java. As we've seen with JRuby, or you can use C#, like with Iron Ruby. You can use some other more primitive language, but you have to have that. So we chose C++. C++ is a very powerful language. We use it very conservatively. There's only a few templates that we use that make things much nicer. For instance, we have a template for checking if an object is a kind of a class. So it's actually named kind of. The construct looks fairly similar to Ruby. We have a bunch of core classes that do very primitive things like array and fixNum and bigNum. These sort of things are represented by C++ classes of exactly the same name. So we have an array, capital A, RRAY, class in C++ that provides the primitive operations for the array class.
Does C++ benefit performance, or are all the benefits on the development side?
So that's a great question. So C++ is obviously a very fast language. There's a sophisticated compiler for it. To do the very low-level things like interpreting the bytecodes, looking up methods, finding constants, the implementation of the garbage collector is also in C++. These are the fundamental primitive operations that are required to implement Ruby.
Is the C++ VM faster than the C VM?
Yes, it's more performant, but it's also a better architecture. So one of the reasons that Evan embarked on the whole adventure of writing yet a second or a third, I guess, really virtual machine for Ruby was that we wanted to support multi-threading, like full Ruby concurrency with no global interpreter lock. And we wanted to support a just-in-time compiler that could convert Ruby or bytecode compiled from Ruby into machine code in a way that would make Ruby perform extremely well and much, much faster than anybody had been able to do in the past. So there's no one thing that made C++ a better choice. It was a combination of how well we could interface Ruby with a low-level language. We have some really neat things that enable us, for instance, to make it transparent that in a Ruby class that has a primitive built-in type like array, the attribute for the length of an array is actually an attribute on this underlying object. And that access to that attribute from Ruby looks like you're accessing an instance variable, which is exactly what you'd expect from Ruby. In C++, it's a field on the object. And then, of course, the garbage collector, the representation of that object in the GC heap, that is a attribute that may hold a reference. So the GC knows that it needs to look there when it's running a collection cycle. So that aspect of C++, that it's a better language to interface with Ruby, is really important. The execution speed is definitely important. The architecture that enables us to write better garbage collector and better JIT compiler and some really nice specializations. We know at the time that a Ruby method is created what its arity is, for instance. That means how many arguments it takes. We can specialize the interpreter for that Ruby method so that we don't have to do extra work confirming that you've passed the right number of arguments. Things like that. So there's a whole bunch of things. Architecture, it's kind of hard to describe this stuff without objects and diagrams and things to point to, but basically C++ permits us to do some pretty nice things under the covers of Ruby and actually make it possible to push as much as we possibly can up into Ruby itself and use Ruby code for more things.
One of the features I'm most excited about in Rubinius is how it exposes more of the Ruby object model to Ruby instead of locking it away in C.
But definitely, Rubinius, trying to push everything possible, everything that we can up into Ruby, one of the consequences of that is that we implement features in Ruby by, for instance, sending a message. So fundamental to an object-oriented language is that you basically can send a message and the object that receives that message may handle it, or the message may dispatch up to a superclass or an included module, may end up in method missing. But at the point that you send the message, there's not knowledge in the code right there about where that message will be handled. Some people sort of skip over what sounds sort of like fluffy, like, oh, we're not really sending messages. We're actually calling a method, a concrete procedure abstraction, you know, some code somewhere that runs. But really, object orientation, one of the key pillars of object orientation is about polymorphism and sending a message that may be handled somewhere in the hierarchy. And that's much more faithful in the implementation of Rubinius. In MRI, by contrast, there's a lot of functionality that is dispatched directly through a C function call that never gets to go through the normal Ruby method dispatch. And so your objects are not privileged. They don't get to participate in that. And you can't make as elegant a solution to problems when there's a big opaque barrier between you and most of the implementation. And then everything sort of sits on top of that. One of the really, I consider negative consequences of the implementation strategy that MRI uses is that people tend to write Ruby code that doesn't conform as well to object-oriented principles as, say, Smalltalk, because you can override a critical method in MRI. And since MRI is dispatching with a direct C call, not through the normal method dispatch mechanism, MRI continues to function just fine, but then your program has a glaring either, you know, Liskov violation or has to do some weird workaround because it actually doesn't get to participate in the object-oriented implementation. It's one of the more frustrating things from our standpoint, from that of implementing Rubinius, and someone will try their code and it will break in some weird way. And then we go look, and it's because this doesn't happen that much anymore. But at one time, people would remove every single method from an object. And we actually use those methods to implement some of the functionality on that object. So if you remove every single message or method, how can the object possibly function? That sort of thing. So there are definitely consequences for the Ruby programming language, even where we try to conform to the standard that MRI has. There are consequences in how we structure our programs and how elegant of solutions we can make when there is a big layer of code that is in C or Java or some other language that implements fundamental parts of the system in a way that is completely opaque to your program running. In Rubinius, almost all of the primitive operations actually happen at the very edge of the call graph, or the sort of leaf method, if you will, instead of being right in the middle. So if you call a method and it has an operation that has to be implemented in a primitive way, like say you're concatenating two arrays, so the storage for the arrays is some sort of primitive data storage in Rubinius and C++. And in order to allocate, in order to like create the new primitive chunk of memory and copy the elements from one to the other, that sort of thing, some part of that operation needs to be done in C++. But it's done sort of very much at the edge. We actually implement array as a fixed size thing called a tuple or a tuple, depending on how you pronounce that. And you can get a new tuple and you can copy from the old elements into the new elements. You can do all that stuff in Ruby. The very primitive operation of allocating that new tuple happens in C++. It's at the very end. There's nothing more to dispatch on at that point. So we don't really interfere with normal Ruby dispatch. And you can create quite elegant classes that say inherit from array or inherit from hash if you conform to solid OO design and programming principles like Liskov's substitution principle.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was the JIT. What is the JIT and how does it work?
So a JIT is a just-in-time compiler, and it's basically a very general word, but what it primarily means is some part of the program, some part of the implementation, will take a higher level representation like bytecode that's running on the virtual machine and compile that to a very low representation like machine code that's running directly on the CPU. Now, interestingly enough, it doesn't have to go directly to machine code. In an implementation like JRuby, you could take some Ruby code represented by an AST, and you could compile that at some point down to JVM bytecode. That could be a just-in-time compiler to JVM bytecode. And then the JVM itself, the Java Virtual Machine itself, has another just-in-time compiler that converts bytecode down to machine code. So it's sort of a very general concept. It's basically where you delay the decision to convert something to a lower level representation as long as possible. The reason that you want to do that, the reason you would want to delay in the first place or be lazy about it, is that as a dynamically typed program runs, you get a more and more concrete picture of exactly what types of objects methods are being called on or messages are being sent to, however you want to look at it. So what Rubinius does, Rubinius, following in the tradition of Smalltalk itself and the Hotspot JVM, Rubinius, as it's running, the virtual machine itself, while it's executing the bytecodes, is building up a profile of the actual types of objects that are seen at what you would call call sites or send sites or the locations where a message is being sent to an object. When a method is particularly hot, meaning that it's being executed a bunch of times or it's got a loop inside of it that's being executed a bunch of times, the second sort of profiling that the JIT does is it tracks that information. So it profiles the types, it profiles execution, and when a method is really hot, it becomes a candidate for just-in-time compilation. So the JIT runs on its own thread, so it doesn't actually interfere with the execution of your recode. Most computers that anybody is running on these days have dual core, and that JIT thread can do a lot of work while your other threads are running. But basically, the method gets queued, and the JIT comes along, looks at a method that is a potential candidate, and it starts looking up the chain of methods that called that method until it finds one that it would make sense to start converting to machine code. And then as the JIT runs, it can do things like it can inline methods that were called down the call chain. It can convert more complicated operations to more simple operations based on inserting a guard on the type of the object that's expected. If the guard fails, then the rest of the JITted code won't run, that the method that's converted to machine code will exit out there back to the interpreter and deal with the expectation that failed. But basically, it converts a bunch of Ruby bytecode into machine code. We use the LLVM compiler toolkit to write the JIT. That's a fascinating project. You can look at llvm.org if you're curious about it. Basically, it's a compiler toolkit, basically. And we can generate the LLVM IR intermediate representation, and then LLVM does a bunch of optimizations on that. And then the really hard instruction selection and instruction scheduling, and which particular machine code instructions to execute in what sequence, where to put values in registers, all of the really, really, really difficult stuff for generating native machine code, LLVM takes care of. And we basically get back a pointer to a chunk of memory that we can call directly, like a C function. And when we do that, the Ruby, what used to be a bunch of Ruby bytecode methods, now executes directly as machine code. So it can be very, very fast.
When you run Rubinius, you'll see RBC files next to your RB files. Are those the LLVM IR?
No. So the .RBC files are simply a compilation cache for the bytecode compiler. So when we parse a file and then compile it to bytecode, if your source hasn't changed, we don't need to recompile it, reparse it. So we save that to a .RBC file, and we can load that instead of the original source code. There are some options now. I know that the .RBC files are a little bit annoying to people sometime. It's not a new problem. Python has a .pyc, I believe, and .pyo files, and we've had .o files in C++ projects forever. But it is a little bit annoying. People are used to Ruby not having some extra artifact like that. So we do have an option in Rubinius now where you can designate a directory where all those things will go. There's a post up on the Rubinius blog about it, and what we'll probably be doing is picking a default, something like /tmp or actually the temp environment variable, something like that. But you can select that, and you can set your RBX opt, which is similar to the Ruby opt environment variable. You can set that to a value so that you don't see those RBC files. But basically, they're just a cache for our compiler to avoid doing more work than we need to.
So those files contain Rubinius bytecode?
It's a representation of Rubinius bytecode, yeah.
Okay, and how compatible is Rubinius bytecode to Ruby 1.9 bytecode?
So MRI 1.9 is a bytecode virtual machine as well. They have a different instruction set. There's been no real effort to standardize on a particular instruction set. That's a pretty peculiar thing for a virtual machine. And as far as I know, YARV doesn't at this time actually write out the bytecode. So they parse and compile every time. So there's really no interchange there. You certainly couldn't take Rubinius bytecode and run it on YARV or take YARV bytecode and run it on Rubinius.
Would you like to see a Ruby bytecode standard?
I don't think that there's much value in trying to standardize it. Again, the particular instruction set is something that is somewhat tied to the architecture of a particular virtual machine and the performance characteristics of that virtual machine. But also, it's somewhat inconsequential. I mean, the Rubinius bytecode virtual machine is a stack-based virtual machine, much like the Java virtual machine and many other ones. However, it's entirely possible to write a register-based virtual machine. It would have a completely different instruction set. It would use registers instead of stack operations, but it would not change the running of Ruby or the semantics of the running Ruby code at all. So it's more of an implementation detail, and there isn't much reason to try to standardize that. Ruby should run exactly the same regardless.
Do you foresee us deploying compiled Ruby bytecode in the future?
That's certainly possible today. Again, there is a blog post up on the Rubinius blog about that. I would say that I have a lot of reservations about that. One of the things is that people believe that once it's compiled, it will be harder to reconvert that back to source code. It's actually relatively easy to convert Rubinius bytecode back to source code. It's relatively easy to convert Java bytecode back to Java code. It's relatively easy to convert C code back to, or machine code back to C code. It's not perfect, but it's relatively easy. Another thing that concerns me a lot is that people might assume that there's some sort of additional security provided by obfuscating source code by compiling it. And that really concerns me because it is absolutely not a security mechanism. I don't want somebody to rely on that and then discover that they've been exploited because they weren't taking the necessary precautions in their application. So with those caveats, well understood, I will hope, it is certainly possible right now to sort of compile your application to Rubinius bytecode, ship the bytecode, and you basically just have a single entry point, like sort of the root of a tree of files that you want to require. And you tell Rubinius to require that file, and it will flow down through the whole rest of the tree requiring all the files. Again, there's a blog post on that. It shows you exactly how to do it. It really doesn't require much on the part of a build system, or it doesn't really require any special layout. You just sort of want to have one file that is the root. And when you require that file, everything else sort of comes along for the ride, and you just use a different command in Rubinius and you're set.
So there isn't much of a performance benefit to deploying bytecode?
There's very little. I mean, due to the fact that we do cache the bytecode in the first place, that only if you're, say, deployed an application, it would be compiled one time, or it would be compiled one time after each redeploy. And the rest of the time, it would be no different. And so there's really no performance implication aside from the initial time to compile the first time.
Rubinius has improved its performance pretty dramatically in the past year. Where has that performance come from? Is it from the JIT?
So the JIT is, I sort of refer to it as the secret sauce. The JIT is really what will take Ruby to the next level. The LLVM project is very sophisticated. There's, you know, some super sharp folks working on that project. They're doing great work. Some of the improvements in Rubinius come from better garbage collection, improvements in the performance of the virtual machine, and better algorithms. Since we do implement so much in Ruby, there can be a big difference between the algorithmic complexity of, you know, two different pieces of code. So we definitely are pretty vigilant about ensuring that we're implementing the core library stuff in simple idiomatic Ruby code that can be executed very quickly. But when the JIT kicks in, it can give us orders of magnitude improvement potentially. So in the Java programming language, for instance, it was not uncommon for the JIT compiler to improve performance by five or 10 times over what the normal interpreter would provide. And we expect to see that in Ruby. Right now we see 2 to maybe 4 time improvement, depending on what the code is that is being JITted. Also, the vast majority of work that we have to do is essentially with the JIT, because what we're doing is learning how to better describe operations in Ruby to the low-level mechanisms that LLVM uses to describe computation. Evan has experimented with a new intermediate representation that would allow us to describe, for instance, calling a method on a particular type, and we can propagate that type information through the intermediate representation so that when LLVM gets it, it can decide where type guards would no longer be necessary. Right now, it's very hard to communicate that information. There's a number of different things that we don't really JIT well right now, and so they will make the JIT not inline when it should, or they'll make the JIT completely kick out when it's unable to compile something down to machine code. And we want to improve those things. Inlining is the key, because the more we can inline, the more the optimizer in LLVM gets to remove redundant operations. And it's going faster is simply a function of doing less. And the way you do less is by removing redundancies, by taking barriers between things. Like if I call one method and that method returns, and then I go call another method, that method returns, and both of them have to do something about checking the type. It's very easy for the optimizer to see that when it's all inlined together and say, oh, this is redundant. You've already done that. We'll just save the value of the previous operation and we'll just continue with that. So the JIT is really, really important. I'm really excited about it. It is the one thing that Rubinius really has over every other implementation right now. MRI has no JIT whatsoever. JRuby and Iron Ruby rely mostly on the underlying platform to provide those services, but you don't have any option in the Java virtual machine to reach down there and inform it better about Ruby semantics. It's opaque. It does its thing on JVM bytecode. So you do your best to represent it as JVM bytecode, and that's as far as you go. Rubinius can take the implementation of Ruby all the way down to register allocation if we choose to. And I think that that's the area that will enable us to improve performance most. And performance isn't everything. I mean, if Ruby were slower, but it's much more productive as a language, and you say write fewer bugs and get applications written more quickly and all that, that's great. All those things sort of are a counterpoint to raw performance. But raw performance means that we're going to write more things in Ruby instead of in some other language as a library in C or Java. And that's why it's so important to me, because I think for the maturity of Ruby as a language, as a community, and the maturity of the tools that we get to use as Ruby programmers, it's critical for all those things that we write more stuff in Ruby, we solve more problems in Ruby, and that's what I believe the JIT enables.
You've been working to get Rubinius running on Windows. Where is that at?
So Rubinius on Windows is coming along. We can actually build the virtual machine. So it compiles and links. We had to do some compatibility work there. There's still a few things that are stubbed out. But we have a fairly complex build system. You know, we have the C++ virtual machine and garbage collector. We have to build that as a C++ project. We have several external libraries, like our BigNum library and LLVM itself. We needed a Windows-compatible pthread library, these sorts of things. We have to build those. We have to compile the core Ruby code in order to load that, the bytecode compiler. We have to pre-compile that sort of stuff in a bootstrap step. So all that was required some coordination. There were things in our build system that we had to fix that were Unixisms we were shelling out to a program that doesn't exist on Windows, for instance. So most of those things didn't take a ton of effort to fix. There are some, like I said, some things that we had to stub out. But you know, a big shout out to Luis Lavena for getting me set up in a Windows development environment. I did some Windows dev long, long time ago on Visual Studio, and so I was pretty rusty. But basically, Luis got me set up. I've got the MingW 64 projects compiler for both 32-bit and 64-bit running on Windows 7. Our goal right now is to have a preview release of Rubinius that runs on Windows, has a Windows installer by RailsConf, which is just coming up here in May. So that's pretty exciting. But basically, right now, the first step is getting Windows running. The second step will be to ensure that we have really good performance on Windows by using as much native Windows stuff like potentially I/O completion ports instead of select. We're doing I/O, evented I/O, non-blocking I/O, these sorts of things. So that's going to be a process of improving Rubinius on Windows. But so far, nothing really fundamental needed to be changed. Most of it was just going through, finding some of the C functions that we were using that might not be available under MingW, and studying some things out. And then going through making sure that we were, for instance, opening files in binary mode so we didn't get the automatic end-of-line conversion that Windows loves to do when you forget to open in binary mode, that sort of thing. So really close. We're excited. It's been a long time. We would love more knowledgeable Windows developers to come help us out and help us make Rubinius on Windows really a quality implementation of Ruby.
How much interest have you had from Windows developers? Have you had many step up and help out?
We've heard from Windows developers from time to time. I think that Ruby itself has not had a great reputation with a lot of Windows folks. I mean, there's been a lot of times where it was very difficult to run Ruby, even after the former one-click installer and now what is just simply called Ruby installer. Before that project, you know, it was difficult to get gems that had native extensions to build, you know, on Windows, or to bundle the native extensions, all these sort of things. So all these things have been a failing on the Ruby community's part to fully embrace Windows as a platform and care about the unique, you know, pains or situations that Windows, primarily Windows developers, have faced. So we have had some people show up. We certainly expect that as Rubinius demonstrates a commitment to performing well on the platform, that we'll see a lot more Windows developers and, you know, basically be able to improve Rubinius from their feedback and their participation.
Where else is Rubinius going, and how fast do you see it getting?
Rubinius is going up and to the right. You mentioned at one point something about the micro benchmarks. Rubinius performs extremely well on micro benchmarks, things at the low level, sort of VM level. We can send messages. We can basically find methods. We can call methods. We can allocate objects. We can garbage collect. We can spawn threads and clean them up and do all those things faster than 187 and pretty much 192 across the board. The challenge really starts showing up when we're dealing with core library stuff that in MRI is written in C. And if your algorithm is doing something that's really just iterating over a C array in C for a string or an array or some hash, we have that in Ruby or the vast majority of it in Ruby. And that's where the JIT compiler needs to kick in. We need to ensure that we're able to effectively JIT all those core operations, stuff like that. So Rubinius performance is improving all the time. Like I said, we're looking at algorithmic performance for just how we write the Ruby code and how we write the underlying C++ primitive code, but also the performance of the JIT. We have a built-in profiler, so when people run their Ruby code, they can compare the performance in a benchmark with MRI, and then they can give us profiling output, or they can look at the profiling output, delve into it, see what methods are slow. Most of those things will be in Ruby. They can go right in and examine the algorithms. Maybe there's a better way to implement stuff. The other big thing about Ruby performance is that in the Hydra branch, what is basically Rubinius 2.0, Evan's done a lot of work to remove the global interpreter lock. So your threads on hardware on a CPU, say a dual core CPU or a multi CPU box, those you can actually get true Ruby level concurrency or really parallelism. You can operate Ruby code in parallel. And we're really excited about that because that offers a lot of things. You could say saturate the compute resources on a single box with a single instance of Rubinius with a single heap and multiple threads for say web applications or other things that require that level of processing. So that's exciting. That's a big part of the Rubinius performance. And finally, the performance of the JIT itself, how quickly we can generate JITted code and how effectively we're doing that is going to be probably the number one thing that we focus on over the next year.
I'm really excited by the potential for parallelism and concurrency in the Hydra branch and Rubinius 2.0. Right now, Ruby has free access to shared memory. Are you introducing memory management in Rubinius 2, perhaps with transactional memory or copy on read?
So that's one of the big challenges with Ruby, right? Ruby doesn't really have a memory model because up until now, MRI pre-1.9 had green threads, MRI 1.9, 2, 1.9, whatever has native threads, but there really isn't a memory model. And we know from Java's experience that a concrete memory model is really important. What that basically says is, what assumptions can you make about the orderings of reads and writes to memory across multiple native threads, which may be on the same CPU on different cores, or they could be on different CPUs. So that's one of the things that we have to address, and Evan has started looking at that. When we talk about threads themselves, threads are a shared memory concurrency mechanism. So each thread is expected to have equal access with all the other threads to the heap or the memory that's available to that process. And with Ruby, that's no different. So it's a shared memory concurrency mechanism. If you are concurrently updating a shared data structure, you as the application programmer are responsible for using some sort of blocking mechanism to ensure that you get the results that you expect so that your writes happen, say, before your reads, or you don't write over someone else's data without the proper safeguards. In terms of thread performance, one of the things that you don't want to have, if you have threads running in parallel because your hardware supports that, you certainly don't want them to worry about synchronizing to allocate an object. And so what Rubinius has had for a while now is something called a state local allocation buffer, or you could call it a thread local allocation buffer. And basically what it is just a way of a thread requesting a chunk of memory from the nursery, and then that thread gets uncontended access so it can allocate objects independently of every other thread. However, the objects exist in the same heap. And so if I create an object and I throw it, say, in some queue and some other thread comes along, picks up that object, it's not in some foreign memory location, which requires some sort of memory barrier, some read barrier or something like that to fix up a reference to that so that the other thread can use it. The objects are allocated all in the same heap. It makes for uncontended access on a thread. And when a particular thread runs out of its allocation buffer, it just requests another one. The GC, the garbage collector, is a stop the world garbage collector. When it runs, right now it's a stop the world garbage collector. We're talking about some options for making a concurrent garbage collector, but right now it's a stop the world. So when it runs, all the other threads, mutator threads, things that are creating objects have been paused. The garbage collector can then go through, process the young generation. If it's a full collection, it'll process the mature generation. And then when the threads start up again, the world might have changed for them a little bit in that our young generation is a copying collector. We may have moved objects, but the threads don't have anything to worry about. Can I reference this object? Am I referencing an object that some other thread created? How do I do that? There's nothing like that. It's just one transparent common heap. And that's really what the mechanism of threads as a shared memory concurrency mechanism, that's what it's about.
I didn't realize Rubinius had a stop the world garbage collector.
Yeah, it's very fast. I mean, we see typically 4 to 5 millisecond pauses for the young generation and in the order of a couple hundred or so milliseconds for a mature collection, depending on how large your heap gets. It can perform very well, but there, when your heap starts getting gigantic, many gigabytes of heap, then the GC pauses can become much longer, and it's at that point when we want to have a different, potentially a different algorithm. But it's certainly possible to do concurrent garbage collection with Ruby. That's not really a problem. It's fairly well-trod territory. We know that we would very likely need something like a read barrier, so you don't read object references directly. There's some level of indirection there so that the garbage collector can be changing locations of objects and doing things with objects behind the scenes. And when you go to access an object, if the reference to it is no longer valid, then some code runs to correct it so it is valid, that sort of thing. It's certainly possible to do that. Read barriers impose an execution cost, and at this point, it's just really not necessary. So when we start dealing with applications that are hitting the boundary of garbage collector performance, then we can certainly look into it more. It's important to note that the Rubinius generational garbage collector is generations sort of as ahead of the MRI garbage collector, and typically will have much better performance and stable application is not leaking objects over time. Then you should see a very stable, it might seesaw, you know, go up and go down as you do processing, but you should see a net, very stable memory profile over time with Rubinius. Whereas in MRI, you're pretty much guaranteed, because of the structure of the garbage collectors, to see unbounded growth over the life of the application.
Very interesting. And this is beyond the scope of 2.0, right?
Well, the concurrent GC is certainly beyond 2.0. That's not something we're working on for 2.0. We've talked a little bit about it. We know really what's required to do it. I don't think that anything is really needing it at this point. So
what else is ahead for Rubinius?
So with 2.0, the big things are full concurrency that we talked about, 1.9 syntax support and codings, and support on Windows, and improvements, some improvements in the JIT with a lot more improvements to come. What we see looking forward, you know, past 2.0, we are looking at some really nice tools for Ruby developers and for people who are running Ruby in production and monitoring the health of the virtual machines, checking in on their applications, making sure things are working well. There's some really neat tools that we've sort of started working on. There's something in Rubinius called the agent, which allows you to connect remotely or locally to a virtual machine from another Ruby process and query it. You can get statistics about how many garbage collection cycles have run, how much time has been used in that, how many threads are being used. You can backtrace, get a sort of snapshot backtrace of all the threads. We have a built-in debugger and profiler that it would be good to access, be able to easily access remotely as well. So if your application is misbehaving, you don't just have to kill the process. You can troubleshoot the process live. Improvements in the JIT, we're going to continue learning about and improving how we communicate Ruby semantics to LLVM so that we can get much, much better performance over time. Rubinius has emerged as a very interesting platform for alternate languages. Ruby turns out to be a great language for implementing other languages. So there's the fancy programming language, which is sort of a mixture of Smalltalk, Erlang, and Ruby, and it's implemented entirely on Rubinius. It's a neat language. There's another language called Atomy, which is a next generation or rewrite of an earlier language called Atomo that was implemented using Haskell. There's a kid, he's still in college, really sharp kid, Alex, who's working on that. It's sort of a Lisp-like language. It's got a little bit nicer syntax. It's almost got Python-ish, Potion-ish. If you've seen Wise programming language Potion, it's sort of got some influences from that in syntax, but it has full quoting, quasi-quoting, unquoting for macros and lots of other impressive features, including a really neat documentation system. There are people who have worked on Python and JavaScript and IO implementations on Rubinius. Those are all in various stages of completeness. But by far, Fancy and Atomy are the farthest ahead. Both of them are bootstrapped and running really well, impressive sort of thing. So Rubinius itself as an implementation of a dynamic language is also very nice for experimenting with other languages. I haven't even started something that he hasn't quite finished it, but it's called a language toolkit. It's got a parsing expression grammar, a peg called KPEG that you can use to write the parser for your language. And we've got some facilities that make it very easy to generate bytecode. So we'll probably improve those tools. And then things like the concurrent GC, those are sort of a little bit further out. We would certainly like to get more data from people. I mean, there's a number of things that we can do to improve the performance of garbage collection without necessarily going full concurrent and using rebearers and that sort of thing. But those are all things that we can experiment. So those are all in the future. I would say that the number one things are full concurrency, Ruby 1.9 syntax, Windows support, and tooling. Those are a big focus right now. Improved JIT support is going to be a continuing focus. The tool language platform things are also sort of a continuing focus. And then much more theoretical stuff like completely different, you know, GC architectures are farther out, as to sort of summarize all that.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your hard work and your willingness to be on the podcast.
Well, thank you. It was great. I appreciate it as well.
And a big thank you to EngineYard for continuing to sponsor Rubinius over the years.
Yeah, EngineYard deserves a great deal of credit. They have been extremely generous. They sponsor development of Rubinius. They sponsor development of JRuby. They sponsored a lot of work with Ruby on Rails and other projects. They have been very generous and very concerned about the health and well-being of the Ruby community. And I'm very, very proud to work there and really appreciate all of their contributions.
Absolutely. All right, man. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
And thanks again to Brian for speaking with me. And thanks to Ruby Threads, our sponsor. You can find them at www.rubythreads.com.